Oh, hello, hello. Do you hear me? Hello, hello, hello.
Chapter 12, page 17. There was a number of 16-foot loads of lumber in sections hauled on the Super Cub in the building of the Mountain House. Also, shortly after the building was in place and painted and all ready for action, I was stopped by a new inspector from the FAA Gato Department, Alaska section, and he introduced himself as a new inspector, and he wondered if I had credentials, and I said I sure certainly did have some credentials, and he would of course like to examine these credentials. Well, I said, fine, but let's not examine the credentials out here in the middle of Fifth Avenue. We may be struck by a garbage truck. I'd suggest we slip across the street to the airport cafe, and we'll examine all these credentials and answer all your questions over a cup of tea or a coffee. And to this he agreed, and he said also over the tea and coffee, he said, I understand you've hauled a 10,000-pound building to the 6,000-foot level southeast approach of McKinley. Is that right? And I said, that's right. And he said, don't you know that it's illegal and dangerous and hazardous to haul external loads tight on airplanes? And I told him I knew that it was all these things, but if properly done, it could be accomplished with no problem. So I told him also that for years I'd hauled houses for the U.S. Geological Survey to their water gauging sites on the far reaches of the interior of the Yukon, the upper Yukon, the Kuskokwim, the Neliwan Bay, Prince William Sound area. So his parting shot was that if he ever saw me haul even a set of moose horns on any of our airplanes, there'd be serious repercussions. But shortly thereafter, he transferred to a different region, and Alaska was saved. Stop. Holy mother, now this cassette's in here backwards, my baby.
It's going. Look.
I know.
I want to show you something.
Chapter 12, page 18 now. In regard to Hakon Christensen in his Waco, he no longer had his Waco on skis. So we used two of my airplanes to take Ward Wells, the great Anchorage area Alaska photographer, and his companion into the Washburn camp. So if you would please make that correction. Hakon no longer flew his skis on his Waco biplanes. If he had of, he'd had to once again operate off the mud flats. I had two aircraft on retractable skis, so we used my two aircraft. Christensen flew one of my small planes, I flew the other. We took the two passengers to Washburn's camp. Chapter 13, page 3. Now the original takeoff did not negotiate upriver, for the simple reason that the airplane couldn't even hold its own against a steep current, the swift current of the Talkeetna River, sometimes running 8 to 10, 12 miles an hour at the location of Chunilna, Clear Creek, and the Talkeetna River. So his original takeoff was a one-way shot downriver. So if we can change the aborted upriver takeoff to a one-way down river attempt, why, that will be accurate. Chapter 13, page 4. Now, to make a real good story even better, let's tell it like it was, and that is that when he reefed the heavily loaded float plane into the sky, he certainly did clear part of the sandbar and part of the alder patch. Now, when he contacted the remaining part of the sandbar, which was covered with an unimaginable tangle of stumps, the airplane cartwheeled and self-destructed itself back into the river, and a few pieces were scattered about 150 feet on a far bank. So you can imagine what a complete job of wrecking this airplane took place in just a second. So, now, you have it almost correct, except that the airplane, as it contacted the stump pile, as self-destructed, it did a series of unimaginable whifferdills. The pieces began raining into the river and onto the far bank, into the trees. So it was a total crack-up.
Finish.
Chapter 13, page 4. Now, in the description of the pilot Losey, let's say that he was in rare form. His clothes, his pants were torn off, his elbows stuck through the tears of his jacket. He had a large knot on his head. He had one black eye, and he was really skinned up. This demonstration of how he actually looked might help along with his story. Yeah, chapter 13, page 7. Now, a good punchline is the way and the way that this episode of the big redhead who used to run the City Hotel in Fairbanks that took the swim and nearly drowned in the Talkeetna River. It's this episode that I want to bring a punchline to. It sort of ambles off into space. Now, I want to say that once she arrived at the Fairview Inn, needless to say, she was the life of the party. In her own right, she was quite a wealthy woman. And no one could buy anything across the bar. Their money was no good. The old Fairview Inn drug people in off from the streets to enjoy the on-the-house free booze sponsored by the very happy to be alive red-haired lady from Fairbanks. And as the Fairview Inn came to life and the various jukebox and the various other noise of the gaieties took place, the sleeping bag would often slip slightly and have to be still further readjusted in order that it act as a sort of a loose dress for Our Lady from Fairbanks. And so she at this time issued a blanket statement, and this was that if anyone from Talkeetna ever came to Fairbanks and was there for the night or was there for a minute to drop by and see her, if they were there for the night, her hotel would be open to all from Talkeetna. Now this is important because the following fall, I was weathered in Fairbanks, and I'm familiar with Fairbanks. I looked down Lacey Street there at the location of the old City Hotel, and lo and behold, it was no longer in its original location. So a patrol car with two policemen was in the area. So I asked them, I said, what in the world ever happened to the old City Hotel? I have a blanket invitation to stay there from the proprietor who had nearly become drowned on a fishing trip in the Talkeetna River. And they looked at each other and they said, the City Hotel? Well, that's been pulled out of there since last fall. End of story. Also, there's several items at chapter 13 that we missed in regard to the lady. As we taxied to the very tiny sandbar, and she's frantically waving her hands, her first words were, am I glad to see you guys? And her next words were, when you made the airdrop, I climbed into the sleeping bag and dozed for a few minutes, and almost immediately I heard a strange paddling noise and a scratching noise, and I saw with one eye as I peeked out of the sleeping bag. an animal. He was about the size of a short-legged dog and had a big diamond on his back and a bushy tail. And this animal was running around wolfing at the sleeping bag. And he scratched at the sleeping bag. And he finally settled for an old dead salmon laying on the side of the sandbar. And as she moved, she spooked this animal. It leaped into the water and swam away with the fish. And she said she dozed for a few minutes. And then she heard a tremendous tromp and splash. And she peeked cautiously from the sleeping bag. And she said she looked square up at the underside of a tremendous brown bear. The brown bear was there all right because his tracks were there. And the brown bear stood over the top of her sleeping bag. And she said she convulsively dived into the bottom of the sleeping bag. And shortly thereafter, the drone of the airplane spooked the brown bear away. And then upon backing down the Swift River, she was more than glad to see us. A genuine, happy lady to be alive. Chapter 14, page 16. Listen, in regard to the military armed force citation for the Devil's Canyon deal, it'd be kind of a poor thing on our part to not acknowledge such a great honor as was bestowed by the U.S. Army Alaska. And so we'll, if you would, please scratch the part about the obscure bookshelf and recovered by my wife standing on edge on a shelf or something, please. Chapter 14, page 11. The Dr. Wilson baiting expedition were not landed at the 10,200-foot level, Cahillna Pass. They did not have a scientific permit. They were landed at the 7,000-foot level, East Fork Cahillna Camp. Stop. That's chapter 17, page 11. 17, page 11. Top of page, chapter 17, page 18. In addition to circling the area, I was fortunate and able to drop medical supplies, fuel, and sleeping bags, and radios for their small battery-operated radio. That's batteries for their small battery-operated radio at the John Day Camp at about 17,300 foot. And fortunately, they retrieved all of the dropped items. Be sure to include that, please. Chapter 17, last page of insert number 3. There's two important items that were overlooked in the landing up at 14.3. And one is, I took the precaution to take a wingman along as cover, North Coast style, in the event that I miscalculated the landing. The one that flew cover was George Kitchen. He was later to make 5 landings in the same area which I marked out once I got on the ice. And the other item which is important was that this is a totally unmarked area at a steep angle, and so I had with me markers in the aircraft. In this case, they were burlap bags weighted with rocks, and I marked out the smoothest area that I could see of the steep grade to land on. At the upper end of it, near the face of the west buttress, was almost vertical, and that is, the buttress itself, the rock and ice was nearly vertical. in order to take advantage of the 30-degree slope, you had to land right into it and turn not 100 or 200 yards away from it and point back down the steep grade. Fortunately, the first landing was a good one, and this is the kind of a deal you bet the farm on. The markers were lined up properly. The wind was practically calm and the light was excellent. And then I put on my snowshoes and laid out a tremendous runway of wands. That's willow wands with red flag markers on top. And my wingman, I talked to him on the HF radio, George Kitchen. I told him to come on and land. And he had prior instruction on landing in steep places. I told George, he was an old-time flight instructor, that upon touchdown at a given point to apply full power with the carburetor heat off and the lean mixture adjusted for altitude at the best power setting, full power at the time of touchdown. Now, this is hard to do for someone that spent thousands and thousands of hours teaching students. When you usually touch down, you retract the throttle, you reduce the power, and in spite of what I had told George, he reduced the power. The grade was so steep, George slid back down the glacier and nearly fell into a tremendous ice hole, and it took 3 hours to bring his plane back up to the takeoff location at 14-3. It also took the assistance of 6 climbers of the area to help him push his airplane with full throttle to get it back up the steep grade to the point of turnaround at the takeoff. Chapter 17, page 23. Top of page. Now, it's really important to say that the injured members, now that's the John Day, Pete Schoenig, Whitaker brothers, that's 4. Helga Bating, the first one, that's 5. Now I got Helga Bating at 14-3 as they lowered her over the face of the cliff of the West Buttress on an ocule. I got her direct. The other 4, I know, but the other 4 were relayed by a Link Luckett with his Hiller helicopter down to 14-3. Now, they're now also, in addition to this, there were 13 rescue climbers that had worked their way clear up from Windy Corner and from 10,200 foot Cahillna Pass. Now, the total number of people was 18, so that would allow for 13 rescue climbers. In addition to this, George Kitchen made 5 trips and hauled 5 rescue climbers with his own aircraft from the 14,300 foot level also, after he finally got squared away back up to a takeoff position and effected a successful takeoff. He came back and relayed 5 of the climbers that had climbed the mountain to be of assistance in the case the weather socked in for a great length of time, and they were at the 14-3 elevation also. Stop. Chapter 18, page 5. A double-check Kassin's crew number. I recall there were more than 6. That's really important. Chapter 19, page 6. The village of Moses Point, present village at the time I landed there, was a old CAA converted to an FAA station, and there may have been a very small summer native camp there, but there were no natives camped there at that time. Chapter 19, page 11, bottom of page, totally incoherent, unreadable. But the facts are that It was not unsimilar to a glacier landing. It was on the top of one of the Von Frank Mountains, and it was with skis. Skis down in their normal position. Chapter 19, page 12, top of page. Now, we didn't break anything. We didn't strain anything. The spring steel gear remained intact. It was smooth as a landing on a feather bed because the snow was about 12 feet deep. It was an excellent landing surface and no damage whatsoever to the airplane. Chapter 19, page 14. Once we got the plane tied down, the next thing to do was to make sure the engine didn't cool. With me, I had 5 full gallons of Blazo and one of the French Thermax heaters that was a dandy. So I placed the Thermax heater in the engine compartment through the accessory oil door hatch, covered the nose of the plane with a big, heavy insulated nose cover, and this is how the plane stayed warm through the 5 or 6 days stay at the top of one of the Von Frank Mountains. Chapter 19, page 16. Bottom of page. Now, Colonel Rogers and the F-102s were flying a grid pattern, but I knew they'd be out the day of the last radio contact I had with Huff. Now, the weather was 20 or 30,000 feet thick, and it was just an instrument grid pattern. You couldn't see anything. I didn't see a flight of F-102s. You couldn't see 100 feet, but I heard this flight, and I had taken a time hack with Huff at McGrath so we would know the exact minute and the exact second, and I would call him back when I heard this sonic sound boom. And finally, in the faint distance, I heard the jets, and then they got closer and closer, and soon there was a loud boom. So I immediately called McGrath, told him the minute, the second, and the hour, and the direction, and the estimated distance away, which was at least 40 miles to the southwest. And in this manner, they knew precisely where the F-102s were at, the exact second, and it confirmed an automatic direction find fix taken from 3 stations in Alaska, Fairbanks, Kodiak, and Galena, on where I was at. And so we were in good shape as far as position. They knew at that time a reconfirmed direction finder triple fix on exactly what my location was. Chapter 19, page 18. I did talk to the transport. It's true my radio was at this point intermittent, but I did talk to transport right into my area. Now, he said, stand by for airdrops of gasoline. And I told him, no, I'm obscured by a low, broken overcast and surrounded by high, ragged mountain peaks, and to please come back at a later time, possibly tomorrow, when the weather clears. Now, the weather did clear during the night, and one of the things I noticed in the moonlight was that I could get a glimpse of McKinley, and I was about 150 miles further to the southwest than I had anticipated that my location to be. The following day, the C-54 made its appearance, and under beautiful, clear sky conditions, at about 55 below zero or thereabouts, made a precision airdrop of 6 5-gallon cans. Now, stand by one. I'll see if we'll read on. The entire page 18 of chapter 19 is incorrect because I had no inclination to walk away from that airplane, because I had a month's food, a beautiful down sleeping bag, and I had the capability to sit her out for 6 weeks, if necessary, right there. So, page 18, chapter 19, no good. Chapter 19, page 19. These 30 gallons, the six jerry cans, came down in three parachutes and landed within 200 feet of the airplane. No problem to find the 30 gallons. The problem was when I opened the jerry cans, they were full of dirty water. In chapter 20, page 16, Boyd Everett's crew consisted of 19 members that attacked the laterals of the south face of McKinley, plus the vertical route. And it should be noted there that of the 19 crew members doing the extremely dangerous laterals of the south face and the vertical, that only one man of the crew of 19 in 2 months climbing sprained one ankle, which is a great show of competent mountaineering. Chapter 21, page 11. Check out the Japanese climbers. South face and their route. It looks scrambled. Chapter 21, page 11. Very awkward statement regarding Roberts. Mount Huntington climb. Sheldon flew Roberts and his three companions to the mountain and after the retrieval. Wow. If you could reorganize that one.
Hello, hello, testing. This is in regards to chapter 22, page 14. I've noticed you've included the birth of both Holly and Robert, but have omitted Kate, who was born in between on September 25, 68. Stop. Again, chapter 22, page 15, bottom of page. Don was not simply, quote, soon plucked from the glacier by a helicopter, unquote. To begin with, he left for the glacier at 10 o'clock in the morning from Paxson's. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, the remaining two Japanese at Paxson's called me and in very broken English expressed concern over the flight. I called Jack Wilson at Gulcana. He is one of Don's best friends and a fantastic glacier pilot. Jack went over to look, but the pass into the glacier was completely socked in. He told me Don was probably just socked in by the weather and waiting for it to clear. I'm sure he said this so I wouldn't worry. But I noticed he said he was also going to call in the search and rescue. And this was my first concrete moment of realization that Don might be in trouble. Finally, at 10 o'clock that night, a large rescue transport flying overhead the glacier, of course unable to negotiate any weather, picked up his radio signal. His battery was working, and the only radio signal he could get out was straight up. Then at 2 o'clock in the morning, the weather cleared enough for a helicopter to get in and pick him up. Slight amusing note to the pickup, the chopper pilots tried to get the Japanese in too. They were certain they must be in shock, but the Japanese climber said, "We come all the way from Japan to climb Mount Hayes. We stay and climb Mount Hayes." Stop. Chapter 22, page 16, lower middle of page. regarding your sentence fragment, quote, those who did not know, unquote, and here you're speaking of the accident, stop. To continue, quote, those who didn't know of the accident, the passengers couldn't help but know that something had happened. Don had two black eyes and abrasions, bruises, and cuts all over his face. He had rammed into the instrument panel. That's what had caused this. He was quite a sight. But he went merrily along his normal way, and the passengers could hardly believe it. Stop. Chapter 22, page 17. Jim, I've marked up your page here. Sorry for that. I would just like to say on the tape also, could you please, Dan Cuddy, who's been Don's banker for years and years, was on this fight, and he's the one that flew Don from the mountain into Golcana. I'd appreciate if you could put his name in. He's been quite a backbone for Don's financial organization. Stop. Yeah, I'm going to comment chapter 22, page 18. I've written on your page again a couple nights ago. This bit about don't worry about him, it's not honest, so I leave it to your discretion. I do worry about him practically all the time, but I've got it down to a science. It's a controlled, like I've put on, written down, it's a controlled panic, so to speak. It's there, but it doesn't show, and I learn not to let it really get to me. Stop. I also might say that it's taken 10 years to get to that point. Stop.